Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lara, WNYC, and there he was. Did you notice? Right in the 1101 newscast, just as usual, Carl Castle, just before he retires and just before he comes on with us in about a half hour or so to say goodbye to WNYC listeners. Carl Castle retiring after 30 years doing the news on Morning Edition and through our show. And we are collecting your five-word descriptions of Carl Castle's voice, and we'll read some of them to him later on. So post your five-word descriptions of Carl Castle's voice either to our website at WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or if you're a member of our Facebook group, post it right there on Facebook, the Brian Lehrer Group, and Carl Castle will join us in about a half hour. But first, Copenhagen.
After extremely difficult and complex negotiations, this important breakthrough lays the foundation for international action in the years to come.
Developing countries are ready to play their part in reducing global emissions, but obviously rich countries have to take the lead.
South African President Jacob Zuma, preceded by President Obama, and let's not mince words here, the main guest who we had booked for today to debrief the Copenhagen Climate Change Accord is writing it off as a farce. Jeffrey Sachs is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. We will get another view on this, too, as we go along to join Jeffrey Sachs. But if you don't know his history, Jeffrey Sachs is the economist most responsible for bringing capitalism to Eastern Europe after communism collapsed in 1989. He consulted most of those governments for their transitions. In recent years, he has devoted himself to ending global poverty. Maybe you know his recent book, The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time. He's discussed it on this program. And it is fitting, I think, that the agendas of poverty reduction and greenhouse gas reduction were really inseparable at the Copenhagen talks. He is also a major advocate of action to stop global warming. For example, I saw Jeffrey Sachs and Al Gore together in a two-man presentation on the issue at Columbia a couple of years ago. But his op-ed today on the website of the Turkish Weekly begins by saying, quote, 2 years of climate change negotiations have now ended in a farce in Copenhagen. And even more pointed, the headline of that article reads, Obama as climate change villain. So with that, we welcome Jeffrey Sachs back to WNYC. Dr. Sachs, always a pleasure. Thank you for coming on for this.
Good morning. How are you, Brian?
Good. How much of a farce do you think the Copenhagen Accord is?
Well, it's a real disappointment, first of all, that 2 years of effort and especially 2 years of opportunity was largely squandered. So that the agreement that was reached is 4 pages of pretty vague, non-binding stuff. And we could have done a lot better. Now, since this issue is a real concern for our future and it's an immediate urgency for many people in extreme environments in the world, the islands or the drought-ridden places in the world, from their point of view, this is alarming.
Did we lose you?
I'm here.
Okay. Alarming because?
Oh, alarming because what was accomplished was very, very little. And basically, President Obama does not yet have in hand a public consensus here. He doesn't have legislation. So he wanted a minimalist outcome, and he got it.
Do you really think President Obama is a climate change villain? I realize you didn't necessarily write the headline to your piece.
Well, of course, you never write the headlines. I don't think that. We have enough
name-calling?
Hyper-language in our society. I would not at all say that. He's on the right side of this issue. But I don't think that the United States, as a political entity, our government and our society has done what we are responsible to do, what we agreed to do 17 years ago when we signed a treaty with the rest of the world. And I don't think what happened in Copenhagen lived up to our commitments or our needs.
So do I hear you saying that maybe in the United States we have the luxury of saying, okay, maybe we're going to go a little bit slower on this, maybe we'll have to shore up the banks of the Hudson River a little bit more to protect the New York skyscrapers or whatever it may be. But where the Sahara Desert continues to encroach, or the Maldives, which may get drowned altogether, places like that, they don't have this luxury. And so for them, it's really, really alarming where climate change might really be a life changer and a national game changer in a short period of time. Is that your basic message?
Well, Brian, I think that's beautifully put. I would just add one more thing, though. We're seeing the most vulnerable places already going into the buzzsaw. And the world will follow step by step. We are in a temperate, well-watered part of the world, and so we're not going to experience the extreme droughts that hundreds of millions of people are increasingly suffering from. We're a relatively rich country, so though it doesn't seem like that to a lot of people in this country anymore, so we can buffer ourselves against some of these shocks. Extraordinarily vulnerable to the hurricanes that the Gulf of Mexico or that Bangladesh is vulnerable to, but we are going to be increasingly vulnerable to storm surges and rising sea levels. Over time, different parts of the world will face different shocks. The world as a whole is on a dangerous trajectory, and Copenhagen deflected that needle a tiny bit. It did undermine the global process that is supposed to be deflecting it by more, and it announced a bunch of high-minded, high-sounding commitments to the poor, which I know from experience are unlikely to materialize.
In a minute, we'll bring in Michael White, political correspondent for The Guardian newspaper, who's got a more upbeat piece today. Headline, Copenhagen may go down as a useful fresh start. But let me challenge you a little bit with the New York Times lead editorial today called Copenhagen and Beyond. And first on President Obama, it says Copenhagen's achievements are not trivial given the complexity of the issue and the differences among rich and poor countries. President Obama deserves much of the credit. He arrived as the talks were collapsing, spent 13 hours in nonstop negotiations, and played hardball with the Chinese. With time running out, and with the help of China, India, Brazil, and South Africa, he forged an agreement that all but a handful of the 193 nations on hand accepted. So what's your reaction to the Times spin?
Well, with all respect to the Times, the negotiations did not begin on Friday afternoon. This is a process that has been underway for 2 years. There's a treaty which has been in force in this country for 15 years. The president has been president since January 20th, 2009, knowing about this conference coming up. Why is it that the United States made its first statement about financing for poor countries on Wednesday afternoon of last week? Basically, to say that, yes, he came in the last moment and saved the day is also to say that for the 11 months of the year, not much happened. And unfortunately, that's the case.
All right. Let's take a break. Can we do that right now? We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to bring in Michael White, political correspondent for The Guardian, who's got another take on this. And listeners, we can take your phone calls for Jeffrey Sachs and Michael White on what Copenhagen hath wrought. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Ben Carl Castle. Brian Lehrer in WNYC with Life After Copenhagen with Jeffrey Sachs from the Columbia University Earth Institute and author of The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time, and now also Michael White, political correspondent for The Guardian newspaper in the UK. Michael, thank you so much for joining us. Hello.
Hello.
So your article today is headlined, Copenhagen May Go Down as a Useful Fresh Start.
I'm a glass half full man myself, and when you said in your introduction that Dr. Sachs said it had all been a farce, I was braced for difficulty. But in fact, everything he's said on air so far has been perfectly level-headed and sensible. It was a bit of a disappointment, but I'm a glass-half-full man, so I thought maybe we can build on this. I'm sure we will.
So which part of the glass is full, Michael? Explain it.
An important component of it, in a sense, is not the technical detail stuff, the communique, in as much as I understand the finer points. And like most people listening, I need them explained to me at dictation speed, one aspect of it is the sheer universality of it. This is a United Nations process, as everybody who lives on Manhattan knows. The United Nations is a clumsy instrument for obtaining a world consensus and decisions to do anything much a lot of the time. But here you had those tiny Pacific islands and China and the United States all in the same room, more or less, very informal processes. Friends of mine who were there, I wasn't, said it was astonishing that minor officials were talking to presidents and people were running through, and at least two people there told me that President Obama's sleeve brushed theirs. Naturally, they're very excited by this, but that side of it can only be a remarkable thing, and when the dust has settled and when we move on to the next meeting in Bonn, and then after that next December in Mexico City, let's hope they've learned from their procedural errors and their political carelessness and things which went wrong, and try a little harder, because Dr. Sachs is right. It is very urgent, and what's more, you're both wrong. The United States doesn't have that luxury, you know. We're all in this mess together, and when one of you said hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico don't brush us, you lost a major port city a couple of years ago, New Orleans, I remember, and that could be by some attributed to the changing weather. We're all experiencing the changing climate. So we're all in this. We really are.
And I don't think anybody...
Michael, just to be clear, I spoke badly when I said us. I meant New York City.
There's an America out there, too.
No.
Right.
The Gulf of Mexico obviously is impacted. And by the way, New York City is also vulnerable to a hit by hurricanes.
So is Great Britain.
If we lose
the Gulf Stream, we're in trouble.
I want to make that clear.
Okay, fair enough. We're running around in circles agreeing with each other. Now, on the glass half full fluid itself, Jeffrey Sachs, to go back to the Times editorial, it says there were two keys to the deal. One was a dramatic offer of $100 billion in aid from the industrialized nations to poorer countries to help them move to less polluting sources of energy and to deal with drought and other consequences of warming. The offer had an instant soothing effect on many poorer nations that had been threatening to walk out all week. The other was China's willingness to submit to a verification system under which all countries would agree to report on their actions and, assuming details could be worked out, open their books to inspection. Transparency is a huge issue in Congress, it says, and Mr. Obama made clear in his opening remarks on Friday that he would not agree to a deal unless China gave ground. So, Jeffrey Sachs, on those two things, are they insignificant? Are they smoke and mirrors? China's willing to at least move toward verification, and the $100 billion in aid from the industrialized nations to poorer ones.
Well, when Secretary Clinton made that statement on Wednesday, and of course the bloggers got all upset about giving away U.S. money, I would tell them they can calm down. What she said was that the United States is prepared to work with other countries toward a goal of jointly mobilizing $100 billion by 2020 from a wide variety of sources, public and private, bilateral and multilateral, including alternative sources of financing. In other words, there's almost nothing in that statement. For me, who lives literally hour to hour, day to day, on the empty vapor of promises of development aid, something promised 11 years from now without any specific commitments from the one making the announcement, no mechanisms, no clarity, no money in the budget. Unfortunately, that's words. Maybe someday it will turn into something, but I know that much more pressing immediate announcements, much more specific, also don't get fulfilled. So I don't think there's too much there.
And on China, which started the conference saying any verification system would be a violation of its sovereignty, then finally promising to submit to some kind of verification system?
Well, they didn't quite. What they said was something around the sense of that there would be an international consultation. Okay, this is something worth discussing, definitely. I don't think that there was a profound breakthrough. I'm also not here to bash any kind of progress. This is after 2 years of what's supposed to be a detailed process. To be facing this in the last minutes, literally, is an absurd process, actually. And there's no reason why it has to be this way. And we could be a lot more logical, a lot more forthright, not throwing numbers around at the very last moment. Of course, I do blame the UN bureaucracy, the secretariat so-called, for a lot of this. But I also blame the United States and some others who have a clear legal responsibility under a treaty signed 17 years ago that they simply don't want to acknowledge, because in our public, Brian, nobody knows about that legal responsibility. No one particularly cares about it. The president doesn't explain it. He doesn't tell the American people that we have certain legal obligations internationally. And so this is all minimalist stuff, as if nature can wait.
And Michael White, political correspondent for The Guardian, any different take on the $100 billion sort of promise to try to run around gathering the money, or China tiptoeing into a verification scheme?
Yeah, well, Jeffrey Sachs is right about the money. It is pretty flaky. You can move dollars around. An agricultural dollar can count as a climate change dollar on promises which are made, and of course, as he implies, promises which are recycled. So you can only hope on that. We've already reneged somewhat on the Glen Eagles agreement to help Africa, and that was only, what, four years ago, not 17. Chinese verification, I think all of us in the West constantly have to remember that the Chinese have only just emerged in the last 20 years from what they regard as a century, two centuries of utter humiliation and near dismemberment by the Western powers. And you've got to cut them a bit of slack. Again, I'm going to be a half-glass full man. Their delegates at Pittsburgh last spring and again here have been huge and impressive and have sort of eyeballed the United States in ways which are probably going to represent the future shape of the G2 of global negotiations. The United States has to adjust for that. And, of course, Dr. Sachs is also right about the horrible lack of public consensus in your country in particular. None of us are brilliant, but you seem to be a bit worse than the rest of us in acknowledging all that we've got to do, and that we're going to have to change how we live and maybe even accept a lower standard of living if we assume this climate change thesis is correct. And I'm with the French philosopher Blaise Pascal, who famously said, Pascal's wager, well, we might as well assume it's correct, because we'll lose very little if it isn't, and we'll lose everything if it is.
Michael White with the characteristic British dry humor, but the uncharacteristic British optimism today. Michael, as a political correspondent for The Guardian, I wonder if you have any comment on the political brinksmanship in the negotiations on Friday. As it's been reported, China's leader, Wen Jiabao, was trying to play Obama for the fool, negotiating without him with India, Brazil, and South Africa, the core group that was hammering out the deal. And President Obama literally burst into the room and demanded that he be included right then, and they stopped the secret talks. And the press in this country, at least, is making the president out to be anything but a climate change villain for that, and anything but a fool in that showdown. Any thoughts about that dramatic moment?
We've read about that, and as you say, it's extraordinary and surprising, but it's also part of the shape of the future world. The countries you rattled off, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, are the countries which are both enormously developing economic powers, but with that, of course, goes pollution. And there was the Chinese using its new muscle, its new international status, the largest holder in the world of U.S. dollars, of course, which concentrates minds, doing it its way. And that's part of the way the future is going to be, whatever the United States Senate thinks about it. So we're going to have to get used to that stuff. I should add, the Europe was excluded almost entirely from some of these endgame talks. Little old Europe, which is now old and a bit elderly and trying to make all the right noises about raising its climate change target cut from 20 to 30%.
And Europe, by the way, to give Europe its due, Europe, I think, is left standing at the end of this as the only region with an actual binding climate change policy, binding on itself, while no one else has a binding policy on themselves, not China, not the United States, not India, correct?
Yes, I think that is correct. And I wouldn't want you to come away with the notion that we're all very virtuous and live by windmills. But we've made some progress in the last few years with emissions trading and things of that kind. And we're also, most of us, close to the ocean, and that concentrates minds.
So, Jeffrey Sachs, do you think that this accord, such as it is, makes it any easier for President Obama to get the binding cap-and-trade carbon-limiting system through Congress?
I doubt that it's going to make too much difference one way or the other. This is going to be a very hard sell, period. The votes are not there. The legislation's been put off at the earliest till next spring. There are already the clear murmurings that maybe that's too close to the midterm elections. It would be a cliffhanger, probably akin to what we're seeing on the health care. In any event, and I don't think that he brought home anything that's going to be so convincing or so overwhelming that it's going to change many minds here. So it's a tough sell. I don't think it does damage. I don't think it really helps. It is part of our need ourselves. I think we need to emphasize that. We have major climate risks, and we already have clear cases of those damages, whether it's droughts in the American Southwest, whether it is the increasing intensity of hurricanes in the Caribbean Basin. But there's a lot more to come. So we have the need. We also have the international obligation, but we don't have the public will and certainly not the political consensus.
Are you a cap-and-trade fan, by the way? We had James Hansen, the father of global warming science, here last week from NASA and Columbia University, who said only a carbon tax will work. I know carbon tax was Al Gore's position, at least originally. Mayor Bloomberg was on television yesterday saying he also favors a carbon tax as the only effective way to stop greenhouse gas emissions.
Yes, there's a near consensus among economists and just about everybody who's not a politician or a Wall Street trader that a carbon tax is the most direct, predictable, easy to administer, transparent, efficient way to do this. The reason we've gone this other route is that politicians don't want to say the word tax, and those who will be involved in creating a market that doesn't even have to exist, because a carbon tax would be a much more direct way to accomplish that price on emissions. For those of us not trying to be in that business, a tax makes a lot more sense.
I guess I wonder still, though, why a carbon tax simply doesn't allow oil and coal companies to price in the cost of polluting and charge all of us so that they can keep their profit margins, you know, the mere cost of doing business, as taxes so often are for major industries, while a cap, the word itself, sounds like the government actually placing a maximum on the amount of carbon pollution that's allowed, and then let industry work it out.
Well, I think there are two aspects to that. One is that if the price is right, and a lot of estimates show $30 or $40 a ton of carbon dioxide is about the right price, lots of technologies that are low carbon or zero carbon technologies simply become more profitable for businesses. Lots of power supply from renewables or solar or wind simply becomes more attractive than buying it from a coal plant. Carbon capture and sequestration, if it's proved as the engineers think that it can be, simply becomes profitable at those prices. So basically, you drive a wedge between the dirty kinds of ways of doing things and the low-carbon ways of doing things, and that's really the idea. The other point, though, is that with a cap, of course, the way that a cap would work is that if it really squeezes, the price on that cap would soar, so it would be, in effect, like a tax on carbon emissions, the same idea. And what everybody acknowledges in Washington is, oh, we'd never let it get so high. Of course, we'd have to increase the supply of these permits if it started to bite so much that it would threaten to damage the economy.
So the cap would rise.
So you'd cap the price on those permits in any event. But with the tax, it's easy to collect. You collect it at the wellhead. You collect it at the LNG terminal. You collect it at the coal face. You don't have to go through thousands or tens of thousands of enterprises to do it. You also can set a price that is known and reliable for a 10 or 20 year period, really changing the investment profile. Whereas with this cap and trade, what we've seen is huge ups and downs in the market, so volatile that they don't really give the confidence for long-term technical change.
Michael White from The Guardian, but before you go, if you want to pile in on that, you can, but I'm just curious,
Jeffrey Sachs's last point is an important one, volatility of carbon pricing for what we call the emission trading scheme in the European Union has been a big setback. You don't know where you stand, and people are all set to go to invest in renewables, windmills, and all sorts of other things, barrages. And then the price changes because the world energy prices change for external reasons, and you're in difficulty. So it's fascinating listening to him describing all the problems which we are familiar with. In the early days of the emissions trading scheme, the allowances were set too high, and a lot of big industries made quite a lot of money easily from the trading system. But it gets refined and gets improved, and we're going to have to address them one way or another.
Interesting. Michael White, political correspondent for The Guardian, thank you very much for joining us. And Jeffrey Sachs, before you go, how did the end of global warming and the end of poverty, title of your book, your other main interest, intersect for you? I mean, you're dogged on global warming, and you wrote the book, The End of Poverty, with really that as your primary life's work. Are the two incompatible? Sometimes it seems that way.
Well, what is incompatible is runaway climate change and the end of poverty. If we just continue doing what we're doing, we're going to find that large parts of this planet where vast numbers of people live won't be able to feed themselves, won't be able to survive. We'll see unwanted large-scale migration. We will see crisis that we're already seeing in the drylands, that we're already seeing in the some of the low delta areas. So we're building up a massive crisis. On the other hand, there are, just as with poverty, real solutions that are not going to break the bank, that are actually going to save the economy and could even stimulate a new way of economic growth, electric vehicles, renewable energy, and so forth. We've just got to decide that we're going to take the future that makes sense, that does lead to survival, and it will also create a new economic future for us as well. On both counts, there's reason for optimism. We just have not seized the opportunity yet.
One other thing, real quick, in 1 minute, and then we have Carl Castle standing by to say goodbye to WNYC listeners after 30 years of doing the news on Morning Edition. He's going to be retiring. One other issue. We were intrigued on my team by your recent statement that cell phones could be transformative technology in the fight against global poverty. In this country, we tend to think of cell phones primarily as a toy for relatively affluent people. What's the connection between cell phones and ending poverty?
Cell phones have ended isolation in the most remote places in the world. In camel herder villages in northeast Kenya where we're working, the herdsmen now have cell phones. Not only can they find their way, they know which market to sell their camels, their goats, and their sheep. Businesses are sprouting up, information for emergency medical care, distance learning through broadband wireless. This is the most amazing change just in the last few years, the most powerful new tool that we have to fight poverty, hunger, and disease, in fact.
Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, author of The End of Poverty. Thank you so much for debriefing Copenhagen with us and taking so much time.
Really a pleasure to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, Carl Castle, to say goodbye after 30 years on Morning Edition in a minute.